Well, thank you very much, Kendrick. It's great to be here and see so many familiar faces. So I'm going to talk about things you can learn from cosmic microwave background other than inflationary B-modes. And I'll give you a little bit of a review, although this audience probably doesn't need a lot of background. And then discuss primordial magnetic fields, related observations of birefringence and their relation to axion-like fields and cosmic strings. So we learned a lot from plots like this. This is the Planck power spectrum. And what we've learned from it is that the simplest, the most basic inflationary models fit that spectrum really well. So these are the predictions from inflation, homogeneity, flatness, Gaussianity, adiabatic initial conditions, etc. And these are the facts we've learned from CMB. We're very close within a small error bar of the statements, except we haven't quite confirmed the last one. And we just have a bound on the gravitational waves. And inflation doesn't have a firm prediction. It can be anything. So the status of inflation as of now, it's accepted as a working paradigm. And it contains, in my opinion, a beautiful idea. I'm coming from the camp of cosmic strings, just so you understand. It took me a while to even accept inflation as a even working paradigm. But I admit it works, and I appreciate the beautiful idea that quantum uncertainty can become a physical perturbation. So in my opinion, that's the most beautiful thing. But there are many open questions, and inflation, being a very successful paradigm, is not related to the rest of the physics. So that's the big challenge, to derive it somehow connected to particle physics and gravity and all the other things we know about physics. And so learning this last observation, learning a bit more about this background of gravitational waves could go a long way. And for example, telling us the energy scale of the inflation. So for that, we'll need to look at polarization of the CMB. And just so that we agree on what I'm showing, so this is a lightning review of CMB polarization. So on the sky, you measure the Stokes parameters. The first one is the intensity. The other two are the parameters characterizing linear polarization, Q and U. Okay, and you can represent, and there is no circular polarization expected in conventional models. And you can represent polarization as a combination of colors denoting the intensity with rods assigned at each point denoting the strength and the orientation of the polarization vector. So it's a headless vector. It's like a rod, right? And so you can define the magnitude and angle. But you can't learn much by just looking at Q and U, in particular if because they are coordinate dependent. So you have to, they are defined with respect to specific axis X and Y. So people look at their so-called modes or patterns. So it's a non-local relation to Q and U, where you isolate patterns that look like gradient-like patterns or vertical patterns, and correspondingly called E and B modes. So gradient-like patterns are expected because you have gradients of intensity, and they've been measured. But B-modes require some cooler physics. They require physics that has handedness in it, whether it's gravitational waves with two modes of polarization or vorticity of some sort. So it requires an ingredient that we don't have by default in our standard model. So anything you measure with B-modes is very interesting. And this is the smoking gun that all these experiments that are being built will be looking for. We're looking for the inflationary gravitational wave prediction, which looks like this blue dashed line. for a particular value, like roughly equal to the current upper bound. And it's this, there's also the prediction from weak lensing, and so you would be seeing the combination of the two. And lensing can be subtracted to a good degree using mod coupling correlations of temperature and polarization. But the interesting thing here is that the energy scale of the inflation scales as quartic root of R. So if R is not within, let's say, if we lower the bound of R by, let's say, two orders of magnitude, suppose we measure R to be below 10 to minus 3 or 10 to minus 4, that's just a factor of a few, at best, improvement in the bound on energy of inflation. So unless we are already close to 10 to the 16, unless inflation happened very close to the 10 to the 16 GeV, there is no hope. Okay, so in my biased opinion, there is practically very little chance of seeing R. So the question is, what else can we do with this wonderful experiment? Yeah. Dust? Yes, you'll see a lot of dust. So dust is what they definitely see already. Yeah. So, but you can, with all that, you can still have a positive outlook and say, well, it's great. So when this BICEP results, BICEP 2 results came out, one of the greatest thing about them was that technology has come to the point where we can actually measure B modes. Before, we only had upper bounds. So it's an amazing technological breakthrough. And so the era of precision B mode measurements is now open. We can measure, for example, the contribution from the lensing has already been measured. And we can study other stuff. So we can, for example, find constraints on the number of relativistic species, neutrino masses as well. Primordial magnetic fields, defects, birefringence, which I'll mention, and things I won't mention but I kind of keep an eye on is dark energy and modified gravity. And even relatively mediocre B-mode data can give quite important information because there is simply not a lot of sources of B-modes. Okay? So I'll start with implications for primordial magnetic fields. We probably all know that there are magnetic fields measured in pretty much every gravitationally bound structure in galaxies, well, stars, planets, also galaxies, clusters. And when it comes to galaxies, it seems to be that all of them contain magnetic fields between 1 to 10 microgauss. And that's independent of the type of the galaxy or their age. So even a galaxy that is really, really young, at very high redshift, already has a few microgauss fields. So that's a bit of a puzzle. And there are two competing hypotheses, which are not really competing. Most people agree that it must be some combination of the two. But one is the pure dynamo mechanism, where you start with some seed, which still has to be provided somehow, and then amplify it through dynamo. Or it's purely primordial, where you had a magnetic field frozen in the primordial plasma, which then collapsed during structure formation, and you got approximately microgauss field by collapse of a nanogauss field in a 1 megaparsec size payload. So there is also some evidence that magnetic fields could be in a space, in an intergalactic space, and that comes from cosmic rays. So just to briefly explain how it works, you have this is based on this paper, you have, let's say, TeV source blazars coming from a given point on the sky that shoot with certain periodicity. So normally they would hit a loose photon in the space, like extragalactic background light photon. And because of this super high energy, they would actually have enough energy to produce an electron and positron pair. And they would just go on together, eventually scatter some CMB photon, and that would upscatter the CMB photon into a pair of gamma rays. So you would expect to see a halo of gamma ray, GV energy gamma rays surrounding a TeV laser source. But if you have magnetic fields, then this electron and positron separate. They go opposite ways, and they scatter out of your line of sight. So you don't see that halo. So based on the non-observation of that halo, these people here put a lower bound on the strength of the magnetic field. That's been about 10 years ago. And since then, a lot of more complications were thought of that could affect that bound. The bound is still a lower bound, but it's gone down because there can be other effects that account for this. Nevertheless, there is a possibility that there is magnetic field in this void space. And in general, cosmic rays will be a very nice probe of magnetic fields when we get a lot of data. The other side of the story is that all there are events in the universe that would have produced magnetic fields. So it's not a question of whether they would produce magnetic fields, but how much. So you have phase transitions, inflation, and anything you learn about primordial magnetic fields gives you a handle on a theories of the early universe that would have produced them. And CMB is in a unique position. If you see something at the redshift 0.5 or redshift 2, you see a magnetic field in voids. It's still possible that it's just astrophysics playing a trick on you. Astrophysics is a complicated subject, so you could have magnetic fields ejected from supernova or something into this void space and filling it. But if you see it at redshift of 1,000, it has to be primordial. So CMB would be the most conclusive way. And one thing that we expect from this next generation experiments that will go after the inflationary B-modes, as a byproduct, as I'll show, they can lower the bound from 1 nanogauss to 0.1. It doesn't seem a lot, but it can at least rule out this purely primordial origin of galactic fields. So just to explain what sort of models can lead to these primordial magnetic fields, generically, you don't expect magnetic fields to be produced in inflation because the the electromagnetic Lagrangian is conformally invariant. So the magnetic fields are not amplified like scalar fields would be amplified during inflation. The fluctuations in the scalar fields would be amplified and become classical. Fluctuations in the electromagnetic field would simply get stretched and diluted. They would just stretch as one over. So the field strength, B, would be just scale as 1 over A to the fourth and be diluted. So you need some way of breaking that conformal invariance. So there is some model building that went in introducing complications, like couplings of the photon to a curvature, to something like an axion-like field, et cetera. Okay, so there is some work done on this. There is no conclusive one model that does an amazing job and is very well motivated, but generically they predict if they are not ruled out by some catastrophe, which a lot of these models lead to some sort of problems, when they don't, they generically predict a scale invariant spectrum of a primordial magnetic field. So you would describe a primordial magnetic field using a spectrum. We're talking about not a uniform magnetic field that's the same everywhere, but a stochastic magnetic field, which is random. And so you describe it as a Gaussian random field, except it's a vector field. And so you take a Fourier transform of the magnetic field strength and construct a power spectrum. And you can separate it into the also parity even and parity odd parts, corresponding to the symmetrical and helical magnetic fields. And then there is a connection between the two. And when it comes to CMB signatures, you cannot have A without having, in general, you cannot have helicity without having the symmetrical part as well. And so if we talking about CMB signatures, constraining just the symmetrical part is enough as a start. And then if we detect anything, we can go after the helical part. And there are some common measures of magnetic fields that I'll mention. One is the magnetic field strength smoothed over a given volume, typically 1 megaparsec size, co-moving 1 megaparsec, for the reasons that that's a typical size of a halo that will later collapse into a galaxy. And another measure is so effective magnetic field strength corresponding to the total energy in a magnetic field. For scale invariant fields, the two are equal because there is no scale. It's the same for all lambda. And you can also produce magnetic fields in phase transitions, in which scale, let's say electroweak or QCD phase transitions, but then you produce the most power in the magnetic fields on a very small scale. And so on scales larger than that, you get spectrum, which is essentially magnetic fields are uncorrelated, and you get a sharply falling spectrum. And it looks like a very blue spectrum with practically no power on observable CMB scale. So there is not much I can say about this. At least I haven't thought about this in great detail. OK, so how magnetic fields affect CMB? They have gravity. So energy momentum tensor of magnetic fields would be proportional to B squared. So the energy density goes as B squared. And then you have also stress energy. And you have both pressure and anisotropic stress. And you have both vector, scalar vector and tensor modes. So magnetic fields are a source of all kinds of perturbations. That's why they can produce B modes, because of the vector and tensor modes. They also couple electromagnetically. And there are all kinds of complicated things they can do, like because of the way plasma, the way they behave in the plasma. So on very large scales, magnetic fields are frozen in. So plasma acts as a tightly coupled fluid, and magnetic fields move with it. Okay? But on smaller scales, they dissipate on scales below some plasma scale. And that dissipation can dump energy into the plasma, which you can see through spectral distortion and also potentially through modified ionization history. I won't talk about these particular probes, but they can be also important. And they have been discussed. It's just that subject is quite messy. So I'll stick to things that are not as messy, more robust. So that includes basically the gravitational coupling and Faraday rotation, which is the rotation of the polarization. So there is also an important distinction between sort of two types of perturbations that magnetic field solves. So before neutrino decoupling, neutrino were also tightly coupled with the rest of the plasma. We're talking about energies above 1 MeV, so way before last scattering. So if magnetic fields were in the plasma already at that time, they would continuously source perturbations. But so they would be on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, continuously sourcing perturbations in the metric. And that would, if you have significant perturbations on superhorizon scales, they would contribute to the same mode, the same superhorizon mode that you have from inflationary tensor perturbations. So you get a contribution to the amplitude of the tensor mode spectrum, which is equal to this. So it's proportional to the time the magnetic field existed between its creation and neutrino decoupling. So tau nu is neutrino decoupling. Tau b is the time at which magnetic field was created. And so the longer magnetic fields existed, the larger contribution they have. And that contribution depends on the strength of the magnetic field, which is given by this pi, and basically the length of time it could source this contribution. But after neutrino decoupling, neutrinos act to they are loose, and they can redistribute themselves to compensate for this anisotropic stress of the magnetic field. So even though you have the magnetic field on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, neutrinos redistribute to make that contribution zero. So you no longer have this persistent contribution to the metric. And you, from then on, source what's called isocurvature perturbations. They're just sourced at that time, but they don't persist. And so this contribution from before decoupling primarily sources tensor modes through this. And after that, the dominant contribution comes in terms of vector modes. So these contributions have been calculated. And I'm not going to go through all these lines. I'll just say that the most visible important contribution comes from this tensor mode, which is called the passive tensor mode, and this isocurvature vector mode. So in a B-mode spectrum, they look like this. So the tensor mode can, for a scale invariant primordial magnetic field, can exactly mimic that of the inflationary mode. So for a magnetic field contribution of sufficient strength, you wouldn't distinguish them. But there is a degeneracy between the strength of the magnetic field and the time at which it was generated. So you have two parameters. So you can have a very strong magnetic field that was produced relatively recently, or you can have a weaker magnetic field that was produced a long time ago that would give the same spectrum. That's what, these are three curves corresponding to these three different cases. In addition, you have the vector modes, which contribute at high L, and you would be seeing the combination of the two. So you would be seeing that. And the vector mode doesn't depend on T star. It only depends on the magnitude of the magnetic field. So here I overlaid the points from the bicep to Keck, and these are the polar bear points up here. And you can see, just even visually, that even polar bear with this huge error bars can say something. Okay? And this is a more recent data from SPT with the magnetic field contribution overlaid on lensing. So I have lensing, vector mode, and tensor mode from the magnetic field compared to lensing plus inflation. And these are the SPT points. This is for a very large magnetic field of 2 nanogauss. That's why this curve is a bit high. The point here is that adding these points goes a long way in improving the constraint you had without the B modes. So these are the bounds we derived on the magnetic field by using just Planck, when Planck includes all of the spectra, TT, EE, TE, all of the sort of, spectra that it had. And it gives a bound on a scale invariant field of about 2 nanogauss. If you add the SPT B modes, it goes from 2 to 1. And you think that it's not a, you may think it's not a significant improvement, just a factor of 2. But it's actually a huge improvement because, just like with this amplitude of the tensor modes, there is a scaling that works against it. Namely, magnetic stress energy is quadratic in the magnetic field strength. So your CLs that you measure, CLBB for the B modes, goes as the nanogauss to the fourth power. Okay? So if you improve the accuracy of CLs by 100, you lower the bound on on B by a factor of 3. Okay? So just this 4 or 3 SPT data points lowered the bound by a factor of 2 on top of Planck. So that shows how powerful B modes can be. Unfortunately, because of the scaling, you cannot go much below. If it's nanogauss, if you keep reducing the error bar on the CLBB, okay, you will get to half nanogauss, but you will not go much beyond. So the way to go beyond is to look at the Faraday rotation, which is a rotation of the polarization angle as it travels to us through plasma. So plasma acts as a dielectric material. It has charges, and as the wave, linearly polarized wave travels, the plane of the polarization rotates, and the rotation is proportional to the along the line of sight component of the magnetic field and the density of free charges, which is included in this differential optical depth. And there's a characteristic frequency dependence, which goes one over the frequency squared. And unfortunately, at frequencies, typical frequencies for CMB measurements, which is like 100 gigahertz or the order of 100, so between, let's say, 70 to 200 gigahertz, that's a very small effect. Okay? And until now, like Planck is entirely blind to this. It's completely hidden in all the other noise that we have. But with the improvement with the new experiments, which have a much higher sensitivity, this will become visible. And so that's the point that we're basically making. And because it depends on the density of free particles, the density is the highest at the time of last scattering. So you need to have polarization. So polarization is produced at last scattering. So you cannot do this before last scattering, right? But then also this effect rapidly goes down as the hydrogen becomes neutral. So most of the rotation occurs in the thickness of the last scattering surface. And Q and U acquire this additional term. These are the usual, this is the Boltzmann equation for the transport of Q and U. It rotates Q into U and U into Q. And the rate at which it rotates is given by this tau dot B. Okay? So for all practical purposes, it's sufficient to assume this so-called instant last scattering, meaning all of the polarization was produced at some time during last scattering, later rotated. Okay? We studied how accurate this approximation is, and it is. Okay? So in that case, because you rotate Q into U, you also rotate E into B. And you rotate with coupling L and M modes. So the equation for B, for small angles, it's actually a sine and cosine, but for small angles, it's just an alpha. B is proportional to E, and there are all these Wigner coefficients that complicate things. So then if B is obtained from E, you can build an estimator that takes BE, divides it by EE to get alpha. So if you don't, I don't expect you to just look at these Wigner coefficients and like say, yeah, everything is clear. So roughly what's going on is that B is alpha times E, okay? Then if you measure EB, it's alpha times EE. And then you can get alpha by taking EB and dividing by EE, if EE is known. So you make an assumption that you already know EE, let's say from your best fit lambda CDM model. That's the ingredient that you need. And it's a technique which is essentially the same as the one used for extracting the weak lensing contribution to CMB. When you see these reconstructions of the lensing potential by Planck and other experiments, that's the technique they're using. It's the same estimator, but it has the opposite parity. So that's a nice thing. So the lensing signal doesn't mix with Faraday rotation signal. They affect each other only through increasing the variance in some CLs. But you cannot mistake one for the other. So this has been measured.
Why you cannot mistake one for
the other? They have the opposite parity. This the way you couple with the Wigner coefficients.
But ultimately you measure they,
so you measure, you sum over some, you look at, let's say, L prime plus L plus L modes.
They are not degenerate.
In the case of Faraday, they are even, and in the case of Lensing, they're odd, or the other way around. So you look at different combinations.
But the lensing
potential has parity. Which is why it's parity. It's exactly. So this has been used in this paper by Paul Orbert, on which I contributed as well. So this was a measurement of this rotation angle power spectrum. So alpha is a random field angle. You can treat it as another field on the sky and calculate CO alpha alpha and measure it, and you get bounds. So there's no measurement, bounds, and they are quite weak. If translated to bounds on the primordial magnetic fields, it's a high frequency, 150 gigahertz, it goes into 90 nanogauss. So that's way larger than one nanogauss bound we have from Planck and SPD. But this is a forecast that I'm preparing to go on the archive in the next couple of days. So this is comparing the bounds obtained from sort of conventional spectra and BB. So today they are nanogauss, and future experiments. So you get, we look at the Simons observatory, an experiment like CMBS4 and PICO, and you see that you can go from one nanogauss to half nanogauss. But if you look at the Faraday rotation, today This is a one sigma bound, so it's 90 nanogauss became 50. And so you go from sort of 50 to 0.08. Okay? So with Faraday rotation, you can go, it's linear essentially in the angle, as opposed to linear in angle, and the angle is linear in nanogauss. And so you just march on straight down, and your limiting effect is the noise in your detectors, but also importantly, the galaxy. So we have to look at this through the galaxy, which itself has magnetic fields and it has plasma. So magnetic fields in plasma produce Faraday rotation. And these are maps which are cataloged by Neil Opperman, who used to be at CETA. And I think he left physics by now, but that's unfortunate. He was doing a really great work cataloging Faraday's rotation measures from radio sources that are outside our galaxy. So let's say at redshifts, all the range of redshifts that are outside the galaxy, and making a map, just like you would make a CMB map. So that produced maps like this, and you could turn them into power spectra, CL. And this is what we did in this work. So it's kind of interesting that when you look at large scales or small L, the spectra are more or less scale invariant. Okay? And when you go to smaller scales, it goes down like so-called Kolmogorov spectrum, which is expected by some galactic magnetic field models. Also, if you cut the plane of the galaxy, if you just look near the poles, let's say you look at F sky of 10%, just look here, then the field, this contribution goes down. And near the poles, if you look at the small patches, galactic field acts very much like a primordial magnetic field, which is scale invariant, and has a strength of 0.1 nanogauss. So 0.1 nanogauss that I showed Pico and CMBS4 can reach is also the bound roughly imposed by the galaxy. And so we would need maps like this, but much better. And I believe it should be possible to subtract and go below. Okay? And so that's just the summary that Pico, without including the galactic contribution, goes 0.08. If we put this galaxy foreground in, it becomes 0.12 because of that 0.1 nanogauss signal. And it's very hard to push it behind. So hopefully there'll be maps. Any question?
Pico, you're assuming some sort of angular resolution? Because I thought Pico is just a spectrum.
You're mixing with Pixie.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Pico is a satellite proposal, which has been, they have a paper out.
Okay.
And with, actually, was part of it. And they have quite detailed modeling of noise curves. And so this is, in a sense, a complete proposal. And this bound is based on that.
So how would you separate, because you see this thing, you see it up to the galaxy, every Faraday rotation you can measure up to galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
But then after there's Faraday rotation beyond that, you're just basically intergalactic magnetic field. And how do you model that? Because you just mentioned the galaxy, but there's...
So you have Faraday rotation produced at redshift 1000.
Yeah.
So after that, there's no rotation.
Yeah.
And then you have more of it produced in the galaxy.
No, but there is also...
So if you have a measure of the galaxy, you can subtract it.
But you have intergalactic medium.
In the intergalactic medium, the density of charged particles is too small. There is no appreciable rotation. Also, no appreciable rotation at reionization.
But it's a large distance, though, so I'm not sure. I think the surface density is still dominated by the intergalactic medium. It's like the dispersion measure. It is a dispersion measure, right? So this cast radio bursts, they say. I mean, most of the dispersion measure comes from intergalactic medium. In fact, that's why we think they are cosmological. But anyways, that's just, I'm just wondering.
Okay, maybe I should talk to you and understand what you're saying.
Just say Dragomirius.
Okay. So now you can also, if you're an astrophysicist, and or in general, if you want to understand our own galaxy, this is actually a very good probe of the galactic magnetic field, right? So that's another sort of science case for this CMB experiments. When you look at foregrounds coming from dust, polarized foregrounds for dust, they probe the orthogonal component of the magnetic field, while faraday rotation probes the line of sight component of the magnetic field. So adding this measurement can give you a 3D reconstruction of the magnetic field in our galaxy. So this could, it might sound surprising, at least to people like me, but the galactic, our own galactic magnetic field is not that well understood. So we have a rather superficial understanding of it, the distribution of the magnetic field lines in it. So this could help with a better understanding. Anyway, I'm going to now look at my clock. Okay. And switch gears a little bit. So I was talking about the rotation. And another theory, another model in which you can have rotation is axion-like particles, axion-like fields, like this field A, which would couple to electromagnetism. So this coupling is what makes it a pseudoscalar. So such axions are thought to be the phase of a complex field, which would come in a U1 symmetric, axially symmetric theory, but this axial symmetry, U1 symmetry, would be broken at some high energy scale. So the part of the Lagrangian responsible for that symmetry breaking is not shown. All you are left with is that phase, like the Goldstone boson of that U1 symmetry breaking. But the energy scale of that symmetry breaking comes into this factor FA, which goes under the name of the axion decay constant, or just the energy scale. Okay? So the larger the energy scale at which this U1 symmetry was broken, the smaller is the coupling of the axion to the photon. Now, if you have a Lagrangian like this and derive equations of motion for the electromagnetic field, say for AX and AY, which are orthogonal to the Z, which is the line of the propagation of your electromagnetic wave, then A plus and A minus, the left and right polarizations, would propagate at different speeds. And the rate at which they propagate would be affected by the gradients of A. So the nice thing about the axions and the reason why they are so much liked by particle physicists is because the theories are shift symmetric. So if you it doesn't look shift symmetric, but if you integrate by parts and eliminate the surface integral, only the derivative of A contributes to the Lagrangian. And that's reflected in equations of motion. Only the derivatives of A come in. Right? So adding a constant way. So that has some benefits. For that reason, axion-based scalar fields, pseudoscalar fields, have been considered as models of inflation and dark energy, et cetera. So in particular, they produce a rotation of the CMB polarization. So you could have a rotation that's uniform, meaning it's the same everywhere. It's a constant angle everywhere on the sky, in which case it would have to be proportional to this integral of A dot. So the angle by which you rotate would be delta A, the change in axion, divided by FA. And this thing would be a uniform angle means that there is some preferred angle, preferred direction. So that would break parity. That would be an explicit parity violation, and it would produce this parity odd EB-TB correlations that you would see in CL EB and TB. Now, for such a rotation to occur in an axion model, certain conditions must be satisfied. So first of all, to change A, you need to start with A not equal zero. right? And then it would change. If it starts at zero, it won't change. Also, this energy scale better be higher than the energy scale of inflation, because if the symmetry breaking occurred after inflation, then Axion would assume values that are different in different parts of the universe. So there would be basically many horizons inside the many different causal patches corresponding to the size of the universe at the time of the symmetry breaking. And so you'll be just a random field and no average value. So you need this, you want symmetry to be at, so during or before inflation. And also you need a non-zero axion mass. So a massless axion cannot produce a uniform rotation, because unless you have a term like this, there will be no dynamics. You would put in an initial value, it would stay the same. So you need some sort of a potential for the axion to change. So you need a mass. Now, this mass is restricted to be in this range, because if the mass is such that if the mass is at energy scale above decoupling, which is the last scattering, 10 to minus 28, then axion would start oscillating. It would start oscillating around the minimum of this m squared a squared potential, and it would behave like dark matter, essentially. Okay? And so there will be no net change. So the mass has to be sufficiently small, but it also has to be sufficiently large. Otherwise, there would be no change. So this is the sort of Hubble scale energy. And this was pointed out, by Sean Carroll. When first quintessence models came out, he discussed axion as a candidate of dark energy. So this is a quite a restrictive range for masses to see a uniform rotation. So it's probably, unless you have a very well-motivated quintessence model that does this. And also, you note that to see any rotation, MA has to be less than 10 to minus 28 eV, which essentially rules it out as a dark matter model. So the axion that can be dark matter cannot cause any rotation. And the one that causes rotation cannot be dark matter. It has to be a different axion, because of this constraint on the mass.
Can I just ask for a clarification on that previous slide?
Yeah.
So your argument about inflation was, you said you couldn't have the field in lots of different locations because then it would have no coherence.
No correlation,
but then you introduced a mass which did select at a particular angle the axion, so you set a minimum a equals zero. So having introduced the mass, doesn't that undermine your argument that you want a symmetry that would be broken before inflation?
This, the axion, so the mass term has nothing to do with the energy scale at which the symmetry breaking occurred. So such mass terms are generated by this instanton corrections of the type that Tooft derived in QCD.
So you're not making any connection
It's absolutely no connection. So you have a Lagrangian that describes the symmetry breaking part in which A is the phase of a complex scalar field. So you have a complex scalar which has some vacuum expectation value equal to FA. Okay? And then after that, your real part of that, the magnitude of that complex scalar is frozen. And you're only left with the Goldstone boson. And then you could generate mass through instanton corrections, through some additional anomalous corrections that, like in QCD, that's the term produced due to instanton corrections. You get a cosine squared potential, just cosine potential, and then the leading term is m squared a squared. But okay, so it's not.
I'm sure you're answering my question, though, which is okay. Just that mass term, you do have a prepared angle for the axion field, so it no longer matter uniformly distributed.
But there's not any doubt.
Are you talking?
No, there has to be a dot. So signal has to roll over.
Are you discussing the lower bound or the upper bound? Which bound?
Neither. I'm questioning whether or not you really argued successfully that the U1 symmetry has to be broken before or during inflation. It seems to me to be interesting. mass subsequently undermined your argument once you had to go broken arrow. Maybe I misunderstood. Let's not wait. Because your time is ticking.
Okay.
I think to argue that it doesn't just about as an upgrade, you just seduce it, but it doesn't really generate
this. This term has nothing to do with the original symmetry breaking.
I understand.
Yeah, okay. So
I'll ask at the you
okay.
I think
yeah.
I really not understand.
So the value of A, if you can think of value of A being chosen at the time of the symmetry breaking, which is at a very high energy scale. At that time, A is effectively massless.
Yes.
So it just stays there. It was chosen and doesn't change. And then when energy falls below a scale given by MA, it can become dynamical and it starts rolling down, eventually oscillates. So until it starts rolling down, it remains in the same place.
Sure.
If it rolls down before decoupling, you won't see anything. And if also, if FA is after inflation, you would have different value, A would be frozen at different values on different parts on the sky, so with the average being zero. So if FA is after inflation, A is different at different parts on the sky. And you could form things like global strings, for example. It would become like a...
Okay, yeah, no, I see the point of view.
Yeah.
The mass breaks the U1 symmetry, but leaves a reflection symmetry.
It does break the U1 symmetry. But it's an approximate U1 symmetry.
Yeah, I understand.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this is to get the uniform rotation angle. You need these two conditions to satisfy. For stochastic anisotropic rotation, which is probably more interesting, you only need one of them. So the mass has to be below the decoupling scale. And the axial symmetry has to be again broken before inflation. So if it's broken after inflation, you get complicated things like global strings. And you could, actually, that could be an interesting thing to study because that topic is not that well understood. What happens to these axion strings? Do they scale do they scale with the dominant density contribution or not? So that's actually something to work on. But if it's broken before inflation, if FA is greater than inflationary scale, you get a scale invariant rotation spectrum. And that was first pointed out by Maxim Vaspelov and collaborators. And you get a rotation spectrum that's proportional to h squared at inflation divided by FA squared. And so you can constrain that very well by studying B modes. So Maxim and collaborators considered contribution of this to the BB, to CLBB, and derived some bounds. And it turns out that the constraint is much stronger if you actually look at this mode coupling correlations, just like we did for Faraday rotation. And so if you look at the constraint today, it's the amplitude. This one, it's measured in degrees squared or radians squared. So it's something like 0.1, corresponding to the constraint on FA of few times 10 to the 15 GeV. If energy scale of inflation is at 10 to the 14 GeV. So there is a degeneracy between HI and FA. But if you look at PICO, it's a significant improvement, so you're going to improve this bound by two orders of magnitude in the energy scale, the symmetry breaking. And I'm not at all an expert on string theory, but I read statements that state that this would exclude the region for FA that's favored by string theory, the region where it's natural region for string theory axions, which apparently string theory can have many axions. But anyway, so the natural range is around 10 to the 16 GeV. So if you push it, if you exclude 10 to the 16, you're putting them out. Or related models of inflation, okay? Because there is a coupling between.
Sorry, the mass of the axion.
Here it effectively doesn't matter. As long as it's less than that, so as long as you get some rotation, it's enough.
So can you?
I mean, enters a little bit because if it, let's say it could rotate CMB half the way and then start oscillating, then it will stop. But as long as the mass is below decoupling, there will be some rotation. And then, yeah, this bound will weakly depend on the mass as well. Yes?
I'm just trying to understand why the mass doesn't enter. So you have basically inflation.
No, it does enter, but it's assumed here it's assumed that it's massless.
So what is responsible for the A dots? So what is causes
you don't need A dot. So here in this case you have a frozen spectrum, like imprinted as an initial condition, and no dynamics. So A dot is zero. A dot could be not zero if mass falls into this range that I showed here, right? But so Maxim and company assumed massless, and in this estimate, we also assume massless axiom. Okay, finally, I only put cosmic strings in here because I wanted to show off a recent simulation that a student of mine did, and it was really cool. So let me just look at the clock. So okay, 5-10 minutes should be enough. So B-mods are also produced by cosmic strings, but as we know, cosmic strings are severely constrained. So for those of you who don't think about cosmic strings very often, they are topological defects. Like axion strings are a type of a cosmic string. They form when an axial symmetry is spontaneously broken, and you produce objects which have this kind of a pattern of the order parameter. When they form, they don't have free ends. They can form as loops. And if the space is infinite, then you could also have infinite strings. But they cannot have free ends, and they would be they're topological. So as the universe expands, the width of the string remains the same, like folds in space-time. And so if you just had the expansion of the universe, you would actually be constantly producing strings out of the vacuum, and the energy in the strings would be increasing. But strings also lose energy because they interact, reconnect. When the two long strings intersect, they form a loop. And then the loop radiates energy and dissipates. And so the question is, what is it radiating into? The predominant dogma is that it radiates into gravitational waves. So I'll mention that in a minute. And they produce signatures in CMB, such as line discontinuities in the CMB spectrum. The space-time of the cosmic string is conical, so it's locally flat, but it's globally conical. So if you have two photons or two massive particles, doesn't matter. If they're like this and the string passes in between, the two particles will start moving towards each other, just like on the surface of a cone, parallel lines meet. So that naturally produces anisotropy. And for this reason, strings were considered an alternative to inflation as a source of CMB anisotropies and more generally cosmic structure. So they produce patterns like this in a CMB. And also wakes in meta. As the string moves, you get wakes behind a straight string. So it's like steering meta up. Okay? And the measure often used for strings is G mu. It's the Newton's constant G times the mass per unit length of the string. So G mu is dimensionless. So I was a graduate student given to a project on cosmic string contribution to CMB. And this blue line is what I computed as part of my PhD thesis. And as I was preparing to finish my PhD, Boomerang measured the peak of the power spectrum, which this is actually the W map data, I think. But at that time, Boomerang just measured this peak, which was obviously in the wrong place. And so that ruled out cosmic strings as the primary source of contributions. But CMB can tolerate a contribution from cosmic strings at about 1% level. So it can add as part of a noise. Okay? So if you look at the number of papers as a function of year, this year when Boomerang data came out resulted in a sharp dip. Okay? And that's when I was coming out looking for jobs. That's when I was looking for postdocs. Fortunately, it worked out all right. But then it went up again. So the question is why? There are two reasons. One is, I would say, superstring related. So one coincidence was that at that time, Henry Tai and collaborators and also Rob Bias and others, they wrote influential papers where they realized that in models of brain inflation, you produce, you have U1 symmetry breaking, which would produce topological defects, which are strings. And if you look at actual fluxes inside the strings and the charges on them, they are the superstrings. So it made this cosmic string idea one way to test string theory, actually observing cosmic size superstring on the sky. So string theory in the sky was a popular idea. And more generally, I would say that once inflation won the battle with cosmic strings, okay, it looks like it's inflation. But the next question is, how do you fit that paradigm into actually a particle physics model? And what happens is whenever you try to connect inflation with particle physics, you complicate your scalar field structure. And as a rule, you get, not as a rule, but I don't want to make big statements, but often you get U1 symmetry broken in those models. Okay, so your inflation field becomes a complex field, and then generically in multi-field models, you get U1 symmetries which break and produce cosmic strings. So you could have cosmic strings forming at the end of inflation and contributing in some way. This is a more recent plot, which I made just last fall. So there was this dip, then it went up, and then it kind of slowed down. I don't know why. I think that's because of the gravitational wave bounds.
What's the grade
one? I forgot, to be honest. But it's three different ways. I used NASA ADS. I used Inspire and Archive, and I forgot which one.
Doesn't seem to care about the observation.
Yeah, that's true. To some extent. Yeah. So, anyway, and so if you look at the B modes, they mostly contribute through vector modes, and the peak is roughly at L of 1,000, maybe slightly below. Okay, and as you can tell from this plot, this is at G mu of about 10 to minus 7. They're quite a bright source of B modes. So we studied this with my collaborators quite a long time ago now. We considered forecasts for a variety of CMB experiments and found that even if strings contribute 1% to the temperature spectrum, which is allowed by Planck today, they could still, even if they contribute 0.01%, which is 1/100th of that, they would still produce observable B modes. So strings can be a very powerful, efficient source of B-modes if they existed at those G-mus, so tensions. So the thing is that gravitational waves put a very tight constraint on this value of G-mu because, as I said, they lose energy, the loops being produced, and then they oscillate and decay into gravitational waves. And there are two observational ways of constraining them. One is the pulsar timing, which just constrains the background of gravitational waves contributed by these decaying loops, and LIGO. And today they are of comparable magnitude, the pulsar timing arrays and LIGO. LIGO, I'm sure LIGO-like experiments in LIGO will do better with more sources. But so the bound, conservatively, it's a 10 to minus 10, while CMB bound is 10 to minus 7. So if gravitational wave bounds are correct, there's no point looking for these p-modes, right? Now, can these bounds be avoided? And there are different ways of avoiding them. For example, if you have this super string-like models, you could say, well, maybe they decay into some extra dimensions, in maybe other fields, not necessarily gravitational waves. But even if you consider not string theory models, but just the usual Abelian-Higgs field theory, there is a group of people led by Mark Hindmarsh who persistently suggest that strings should decay primarily into the scalar and gauge fields of which they're made of. So strings are topological defects made of a scalar field, and if it's Abelian Higgs, it also has gauge field in it. And so they say that they do simulations. They don't just say that. They actually simulate this and find that they decay quite efficiently into just these particles, not the gravitational waves. And so we decided to check that out for ourselves. So I had a really great undergraduate student last year who's now moved to CETA. And this was his undergrad thesis project. So we decided to actually produce a cosmic string loop from four straight strings. So we have four straight strings set up in a box, and we make them move and intersect and produce a loop. Actually, this box has periodic boundary conditions, so we actually produce two loops, okay, in the same box. And then the loop forms and evolves and eventually decays. And we can it's a field theory. It's the Abelian Higgs model. And we can study how quickly it decays, into what it decays, and how it decays depending on the initial size, all kinds of angular momentum of the loop, etc. So this is the simulation of how it works, which is why I talked about cosmic strings, just to show this off. So you see that after it forms, there are kinks on the loop, which propagate. And when the kinks collide, you get a bit of a burst of radiation. You also have this cusp-like events when the string kind of folds on itself.
So you have gravitational waves, yes?
No, there's no gravity here. This is Minkowski space with a billion Higgs. Okay? And so there's some details we can discuss about this simulation, but the important point is that, as you could see, the loop persists. It doesn't just collapse very quickly. It goes on. The second loop, the way we produce them, we make one of them very large and one of them much smaller. And then the way we, and then of course it goes away. And then we also, in the simulation, we put the frame around the loop that we want to see. So the other one may still be there, but we're looking at just one of the loops. Okay? So,
has some strong spatial symmetries, it's exactly the reflection and possible plane symmetries.
Yes.
It doesn't have exact,
there are some symmetries that we break. For example, the lines, the velocities are not parallel. Initial configurations are, because it's easier to set up the straight strings, which are orthogonal to boundaries, but we can give arbitrary velocities. And so we don't choose them parallel. And but yes, more generally, it is interesting to study, because you could maybe study things like the rocket effect, if you, where strings are propelled by cusps and stuff. Okay, but we didn't. Our purpose here was to check for how long the loop would persist, and we found that it can persist. The bigger we make the loop, the longer it persists, which is what you would expect. Okay, and can persist for multiple kind of oscillations of the loop. And then we can study half-time of the loop depending on the initial size. So this is the initial energy of the loop. This is half-time. You see that the larger the loop, the longer it persists. And the slope of this curve was approximately 2. Okay? So now if you extrapolate this, what it means is that super large loops, which are cosmological in size, they're, let's say, 30, 40 orders of magnitude larger than this. Okay, we're talking about an enormous extrapolation. They would be quite long-lived by if you extrapolate it up. In comparison, gravitational radiation, half-time, scales as L. So it's a slope that is lower. So in other words, the gravitational decay channel, there's a crossover L at which the gravitational wave channel becomes much more important than the particle decay. It's true that it's an extrapolation. We went from having strings that are boxes that are roughly, let's say, 300-400 size of the biggest box we had was like 1,000 cube. Okay, and the core contains about 20 points. One thing we actually found that unless we resolve the core really, really well, they decay much faster. So resolution was quite important for having the strings actually persist for a long time. And so we derived, based on a simple extrapolation, a crossover scale. So if L is larger than something like this, right, your gravitational wave decay channel should dominate. So if you put g mu some of 10 to minus 10, this is 10 to minus 27 centimeters. So if your loops are larger than 10 to minus 27 centimeters, gravitational radiation should dominate. But for loops smaller than that, particle decay is important. So there are all kinds of quantitative, yeah.
The sort of width of the string coming into this, I would sort of expect more of an interplay between, like, g mu I can see is telling you about, like, the gravitational strength of the string, but I'm not seeing where the width of the string is coming in. You know, the mass of the particles would be the string would decay into.
So, the width, this L is not the width. This is the size of the loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. The width comes only through, the width is related to mu. So mu is related to.
There can be a sort of hierarchy between the gravitational g mu and the width.
Yes.
So it depends on the coupling of the.
Yes. So this is for a particular choice of coupling.
Sorry.
This is a BPS.
Okay.
This is the BPS string. So we choose couplings order one and equal for the, so the mass of the gauge boson and the scalar boson are equal.
Okay.
So BPS strings, okay? So that's the conclusion. So the essentially strings should decay into gravitational waves, and so therefore it's difficult to avoid these gravitational wave bounds. And B-modes, as I advertised, can probe things other than inflation gravitational waves. So if you can think of models that produce interesting primordial magnetic fields or models that contain axion-like fields, we could discuss and see what we can constrain with CMB. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you. Yeah.
I said too, we were taught that the B-modes were actually better. Things haven't much changed since then. So, how can we see the magnetic fields? Which explanation is correct?
Okay, so I have two ways of answering your question. One is there will be better ways of subtracting the dust contribution by having measurements at multiple frequencies. So Pico has more than 10 frequencies, and it can efficiently subtract the galactic dust contribution. And also, the kind of measurements we are interested in are at higher L. What we want is to measure the peak of the modes close to the peak of the E-mode spectrum, which are L between 500 and 3,000, where the galaxy is not as dominant. The galaxy, introduces mostly large-scale foregrounds and less so on smaller angular scales. So we're more interested in smaller angular scales. So combination of these two, and they are fully accounted in this. So I mean, some galactic model was included in PICO forecast. I missed the beginning of your question. Sorry.
R.
It's
0.6.
Yes.
What happens to inflation perception if it goes to 0.1? Now, I know that inflation always finds some potential.
I can only tell you what I hear from my inflation friends, and that so Starobinsky's model, for example, is one model that survived for 30 plus years, and as far as I remember, it predicts R of around 0.01. So that's sort of a reasonable number to expect in that model. And actually, I used to work with Alex Vilenkin, and one thing he said about Starobinsky is that he's never been wrong. So, it was in the context of a highly speculative paper that Starobinsky wrote about dark energy, and we were sort of discussing it at lunch, and Alex said, on one hand, it does look very speculative. On the other hand, he's never been wrong. So, I don't know.
Speculations
about cosmology
are often wrong, but they have many speculations.
That's true.
So on the loop sizes, so I take it from your talk that you baked between Vilenkin and the other groups, the size has still persisted, and you're saying there are more cosmological sizes, or at least you're already supporting.
The debate with
it was always in the what are the size of the loops and it would
The size of the loops.
Right.
So there was a debate which is not a debate as far as I understand, thanks to most recent simulations by the Tufts group, like Ken Olum and Jose Blanco Pilado. There is a consensus now that loop size distribution is peaked at around 0.1 of the horizon size. Yeah, before there was a debate whether it's that or they peak at the cutoff scale. So that went away.
From the crystals, we know there are some location of the relativity angle. But that may not apply to this cosmological
I can't say there isn't, but I can't think of anything specific to say. So something that would couple to the photon and produce that kind of birefringence. You could design different types of models, but I don't want to. I don't have a specific third thing to say off the top of my head.
So if you can go back to this, your part, the last part that you had there. This one. So, I mean, physically, don't you expect tau to be proportional to? Because, I mean, you can, of course, fit anything you want to a bunch of points. But just physically, if you have a very big string loop, don't you expect basically the rate of energy radiation?
This is not the rate.
This is the time.
This is the time for the whole loop decay by half.
Right, but I mean, if you have a very big loop, you think the different parts of the loop are doing their own thing.
Uh-huh.
So basically, the rate of energy loss would be proportional to the length of the loop, basically. I mean.
That's a good point. So that goes into the details. good point. So that's not quite true. If you ask how does the loop radiate primarily, it radiates mostly because of events on the loop, such as kink collisions or cusps. And the point here is that the number of such events is roughly the same for all loops. It doesn't scale with L. So bigger loops have approximately the same number of kinks and cusps as small loops.
Is that
at any given time? Yeah. And there are expectations based on how these loops are produced, and also the fact that eventually these kinks go away. So they collide, smooth strings tend to smooth themselves out, so they don't persist forever. So the number at any given time is roughly the same, independent of the size. And that's why it doesn't scale with L that way.
I'm not convinced.
Yeah, good. So we can talk about some. OK?